Hello, and welcome to The Iberian Knot, a history of the Spanish Civil War. Episode 11, Chaos, Consolidation, Conciliation. Great to be back with you this week and continue on with the battle raging between the two sides in the Civil War and between different factions on the Republican side. In episode 9, we ended the episode with the Republicans and Nationalists reaching a stalemate after a bitter winter of fighting into early 1937. The Nationalists, having conquered all of the area that abuts Portugal, swept across Andalusia from west to east and took the ancient Spanish capital of Toledo in Castilla-La Mancha. They expected to have little trouble in ending the war by pushing into and capturing the capital, Madrid, from the north and the west. However, the bulk of their forces were trained and hardened in deserts and open agricultural lands, as opposed to fighting in large cities, where their opponents had not only the high ground, but far more knowledge of the city from a 3D point of view. They hadn't just observed the city on a map. They were also newly supported on the ground and in the sky by the Soviet Union and international volunteers from all over the world, which helped cancel out the Italian and German assistance the Nationalists were receiving at the same time. So despite thousands of people dying on both sides, both in hand-to-hand fighting as well as from aerial bombardments that were rarely precise, the Nationalists were only able to slightly extend their territory surrounding the city and occupy a small section of the university city in Madrid. The organization and leadership of the two sides in the war couldn't have been more different. In fact, they were like funhouse mirror versions of one another, both of them warped and difficult to discern the inner workings of from outside. Let's start with the Nationalist side. While Franco had firmly established himself in power due to his military experience, lack of rivals, and successes thus far in the conflict, he was not a born politician. The people underneath him, although not in democratic ways by any means, were figuring out what kind of government and philosophy they would follow once the war was over. There were those who had come to the Nationalists from the Falange or fascist-inspired Spanish party that were interested in a kind of corporatism that would divide society up into interest blocks like workers, factory owners, church leaders, etc. And through those state-organized and sponsored quote-unquote corporations, provide for the needs of the people but within a strict right-wing framework that promoted nationalism, militarism, and authoritarianism. Many of the old monarchists, such as the Carlists, wanted to return to the old absolutist monarchy, and they made up a large minority on the Nationalist side. And to round out those on the Nationalist side, you had those fanatics like the necrophilistic Mion Estrée, who wanted to enter into a blood oath of death in a crusade against all enemies of Spain like a medieval caudillo. Despite their differences, the Nationalists in the war were able to concentrate on the training of officers and troops, as well as the planning of new offensives against the Republicans with foreign aid, while their opponents were just trying to reach a state of normalcy in order to defend what territory they still held. And looking at a map of the country in January through March 1937, one would see that the Nationalists occupy, in a shape that somewhat resembles a tree, the far northwest of the country in Galicia, south to the Strait of Gibraltar, with the crown of the tree extending east until reaching halfway across the province of Aragon, down to Teruel in northern Castilla-La Mancha, then cutting west across and above the mountains north again, before heading south to form the top of the trunk at Toledo, and the rest of it curving down and around the bulk of Castilla-La Mancha, but extending its roots around Cordoba, Seville, and Granada. The Republican cabinet had decamped to Valencia as they were pessimistic about the chances of Madrid holding out against the Nationalists. This turned out to be incorrect, but nevertheless, much like when the capital had changed from Toledo to Madrid in the 16th century, the move of the power players in the government to the Mediterranean coast shifted the power balance in the country as well. And although only the president Azaña was actually residing there while the rest of the central government was in Valencia, Barcelona became the largest Spanish city that wasn't under direct threat of Nationalist takeover, making it the most prominent city on the Republican side. Barcelona had started the war with perhaps the largest adherence to anarchist ideologies, but multiple factors had played into their diminution in the eyes of the public and power generally. First, by joining the existing power structure early on in the formation of the local government in Catalonia, many felt that they were betraying their own ideals, which dictated that there be no higher centralized powers and only localized ones. Secondly, their attempts at collectivizing large sectors of diverse industries in the region had resulted in committees at every level of production having to sign off on every decision, and for elections to have to be held to fill the spaces in each of the committees. This meant that the textile industry, by far the largest in Catalonia before the start of the war, had lost over 50% of its production, and the Republicans actually had to order their uniforms from France instead of producing them locally in their own factories due to the slowdown caused by the anarchist extreme labor reforms. Not all of the factories were run in this manner, with many of them foreign-owned, which were also run by workers' committees, but with far few layers of bureaucracy. And in each factory that was deemed necessary to the war effort, like those that produced arms, munitions, and other materials, there was a state representative that, in addition to determining what needed to be produced to maintain the war effort, would also arrange credit and therefore guarantee the paychecks of those working in said factory. Over time, this credit was made more difficult to obtain by the anarchist collective-driven factories, in favor of those that were foreign-owned or under the auspices of the socialist union, the UGT. And while it's true that all of this organizing within the factories did drive higher wages and benefits like a 40-hour work week, all that wasn't very helpful if inflation took away whatever gains the workers obtained. And those within the anarchist movement, such as Abad de Santillan, an economic counselor in the Generalidad, wrote that while the goal of their movement was to do away with the inequalities that capitalism had wrought and distribute the wealth produced by labor more equally, they had instead created 1,000 tiny dictatorships in the form of committees and managers of each factory and farm that all wished to get the most out of their position after having been denied any kind of individual power for so long. All of the failures caused by mass collectivization of factory and agricultural life were exacerbated by the fact that industry in Barcelona had been largely cut off from raw materials by land and by sea. Barcelona is now and was then a major trading center that relied heavily on international partners. Prior to the war, they were able to obtain cotton from the US, Brazil, and Egypt on the Mediterranean. Gibraltar was now in the hands of the nationalists, effectively cutting off any trade with the Atlantic, and the Mediterranean was being patrolled by Germans and Italians on behalf of the nationalists, making it extremely costly for even those daring merchants who tried to bring supplies to the Republicans on the coast. Thus, the anarchists, who had some of their largest groups of followers in Spain as the war began to crumble from within. And their downfall was helped by the increasing influence enjoyed by the communists, as help directly from the Soviet Union and in the form of the international brigades organized by the Comintern only raised the prestige of the communists and lowered that of the anarchists. Looking at it one way, it's easy to say that the communists were on their way up and the anarchists were on their way down, and on the surface, that was definitely the case. However, you only have to scratch that surface a little bit to see that the supposed unity was really propaganda being put out internationally to support the Republican cause, while inside Spain, it wasn't that simple. To start at the top of it all, we'll remember that Largo Caballero had been installed as prime minister in September 1936 in an attempt to unite all of the left-wing parties in Spain, as he was at the time being called the Lenin of Spain, a title which he didn't renounce so much as glom onto. And since this nickname helped him get Soviet support, as well as his act of shipping all of Spain's gold reserves off to Stalin, he ran with it. But it only took a few months for him to feel the pressure emanating from the Red Giant in Northern Europe and resent it mightily. And Largo Caballero was no Lenin of Spain by any means. He was a trade unionist and a socialist that was totally willing to work with even the monarchy in his early years. Sure, his rhetoric could get heated and extreme at times, but at the end of the day, he was a man who enjoyed living comfortably, being in power, and being popular, so he strained against anything that would take away from any of those states. Instead of being boosted by the entrance of the Soviets and the international brigades in force into the conflict, he was almost immediately eclipsed by them instead. He had, after all, fled Madrid when it came under attack, while his people, Soviet weapons and international volunteers had ran into the breach, as it were. There was no way for Largo to come out of it looking heroic. La Pasionaria, the communist leader during the Civil War, had remained in Madrid during the fighting, and her speeches had served as rallying cries for those rushing to fight the Moroccans and the other nationalist forces. General Miaja, who had helped lead the resistance against nationalist takeover of Madrid, found himself more and more impressed by the communists, who he said were resolute, acting first and talking later, unlike the socialists, who did the opposite. There was a rumor that he had joined the Communist Party, even though that had not actually occurred. In December 1936, Largo Caballero received a long patronizing letter from Stalin with advice on everything from the form of government Spain should take, to the military operations that should be undertaken, to admonishments on how the property of peasants and foreign business owners should be treated. What was perhaps the final straw for the prime minister was when the Russian ambassador Rosenberg attempted to persuade him to dismiss the minister of war and appoint ministers that were seen as more favorable to Soviet influence. The explosive way in which he dismissed the Russian ambassador from his presence spilled over to the Spanish foreign minister, Álvarez del Valle, who Caballero felt was not actively fighting off Soviet influence in Spain. This was unfair, as del Valle was indeed a socialist, but he was considered a conservative by his ideological peers. By accusing him, of all people, of treachery, he was cutting himself off from what could have been a future ally, but Caballero was quickly seeing enemies all around him, some real and some imagined. By speaking ill of the communists and the Soviet Union as a force in Spain, and having already alienated the less radical members of the Socialist Party he led, he had sparked the fuse of his own implosion in the near future, as the communists looked for someone that would be more amenable to an increase in their influence commensurate with the assistance they were providing to the Republic. And on the surface, the communists very much wanted to restore the Republic and not install a Soviet-style dictatorship on the Spanish people. There are historical assessments that exist that would say that the whole of Russian and communist support to the Republicans was a cynical ploy to gain as much support in the populace as they could, so that when the war was won, that they could proceed with the takeover that every non-communist feared would take place. And others would say that Stalin in particular didn't care who won the war, as long as it lasted a good while and prevented Germany from aggression on his western border. I would contend that even if one or both of these suppositions are true, that most of those who actually came to fight on the Republican side did it due to the virtue they recognized and not just to boost Stalin's chances of staying in power or winning a Second World War. The truth is probably a muddled combination of many of these causes and effects, and it is therefore probably best to just walk through what was actually going on in Spain and Russia from the perspective of those who considered themselves communists and allow you to draw your own conclusions. On the ground in Spain, the communists were pressing for a return to normalcy. This meant that as much as possible that factories, farms, and mines be run in a fashion that was most productive to the war effort and often eschewed the actual gains the workers wished to achieve through organizing. The most important goal was to win the war, after which point they could argue about what kind of government to form. With this goal in mind, the communists had allies such as the Republican president Azaña and the relatively moderate voice within the Socialist Party, Indalecio Prieto. And so you would think that with all of the support in the war effort, the actual number of registered communists in the country rising to over 136,000 by early 1937, and many in the more moderate intelligentsia taking their side as they supported a united government, that the communists would be the major political party on the Republican side going forward to drive the effort against the nationalists. But no, it wasn't that simple either. I'm sorry, I wish it was. It would be easier to write. Firstly, inside Spain, the communists were rising to the detriment of the anarchists and socialists in Madrid, Barcelona, and all parts of the country to the south and east of those locations. However, in the north, where the nationalists still held territory in Asturias, Santander, and the remaining Basque province of Vizcaya, there were various power and ideological groups running their individual regions. The Basques, being relatively conservative and Catholic, but afraid of the nationalist threat to their culture and language, tried to keep everything running pretty much as it had before the war started, and had instituted very few labor agricultural reforms. They continued to allow their clergy to live in peace, and that is not something that could be hoped for by their brethren in other Republican-held parts of the country. This did not spare them from the bombing raids of the German Condor Legion supporting the Nationalists. Meanwhile, the mines of Asturias were managed by labor committees administered by local juntas. The fishermen of Gijón organized themselves in anarchist collectives, and the socialists ran the port at Santander. And in their midst was the treacherous commander of the Oviedo garrison, who had taken that city and was now under siege praying for relief from nationalist forces. In addition to the complications created by the Prime Minister being in direct conflict with the largest and fastest growing political party on the Republican side, the Communists themselves were divided internally as well between the Communists who were supported by Russia and the Comintern and those who felt that those two power bases were not the true inheritors of Marx's economic revelation. And to understand the roots of this ideological conflict, we actually have to retrace a bit of Russian history. Obviously, I cannot get into the entire history of the Russian Revolution in this one podcast episode, and I of course refer you to the amazing podcast Revolutions by Mike Duncan, being produced at the same time as this one, for an in-depth and intriguing explanation of the causes for, events of, and end result of the Russian Revolution. For our purposes, we'll just focus on Lenin's death in 1924 and the consolidation of power that Stalin undertook thereafter. The long and short of it are that after Lenin's death, there were two more or less obvious inheritors to his power: Stalin and Leon Trotsky. Stalin had been made Secretary General of the Communist Party in 1922, only 2 years before Lenin's death. From that position, he was able to install a great deal of his friends in positions of power, making Stalin the root of all of their power and the focus of their loyalty. Trotsky had been a thought leader in opposition to the Tsar in the lead-up to the revolution, and a charismatic, rhetorical, and effective military leader in the Russian Civil War, in which the Bolsheviks had consolidated their power. At the time of Lenin's death, Trotsky was of the opinion that the newly formed Soviet Union should use its power and influence to evangelize communism across the world and try to stamp out capitalism wherever possible, either through propaganda or force. Stalin was of the opinion that it was best to consolidate the gains they had made in Russia thus far and become an emblem of successful communism that the world could emulate. Stalin was also in the process of consolidating his personal gains, so that was a logical goal for him to aim for. Stalin retained the main power base of the Communist Party in Russia, while Trotsky and other dissidents broke off to form the United Opposition. One of their major bones of contention was how to handle the Chinese Revolution. Stalin encouraged the Chinese communists to join with the nationalists to form a unity government, while Trotsky thought it was best to have a truly communist revolution that was clearly separate from the bourgeoisie and merchant classes that made up the nationalist Chinese party, also known as the Kuomintang. However, the Kuomintang slaughtered communists in the Shanghai Massacre of April 1927, which humiliated Stalin and scored a point for Trotsky in their international argument regarding the future of communism and whether it could work hand-in-hand with capitalists. By 1927, Trotsky and his supporters were kicked out of the Communist Party and exiled from Russia, and he personally would spend the next decade and some change hopping around Europe and America as a hot potato that no one wanted for fear he would spark a revolution in their own country, but also didn't want to make an enemy out of if they could help it. This conflict between two powerful men would result in many splinter communist groups internationally that opposed Stalin's Russia and how it interpreted Marx's philosophy. In Spain, this manifested itself in the formation of the Partido Obrero de Unificación Marxista, the Workers' Party of Marxist Unification, or POUM, in 1935. I'll just call them the POUM for simplicity's sake. In a bit of historical absurdist comedy, Trotsky actually denounced this party because they had formed by unifying the Spanish Trotskyites with the Worker and Peasant Bloc Party, whose ideology he opposed for minor technical reasons. But in 1937, the POUM was the party that was worried, along with the anarchists, socialists, and republicans, by the increasing Russian communist influence in the country. This made the POUM an enemy of the rising communists, as much as Largo Caballero had become a short-term ally of the anarchists. But at this point in the war, alliances could be formed and then transformed to bitter split in no more than a few weeks or months. These differences played out in the different newspapers of the various political organizations on the Republican side. Each side accused the other of secretly harboring fascist spies whose only goal was to divide the Republican forces in order to win the war for the nationalists. The very real purges that were occurring in Russia based on Stalin's paranoia, when reported, were seen as so much more exaggerated propaganda to diminish the profile of the Soviet Union in the eyes of the Spanish people. Meanwhile, the most ambitious members of the military were joining the communists in droves, as they were proving to be the most effective force against Franco's forces, and far more organized than their own central government. As the fighting for Madrid progressed towards spring in 1937, Largo Caballero further infuriated the communists in Russia by refusing to merge the socialists with the communists, something that had already happened with the respective parties' youth leagues months earlier. Caballero complained to Azaña that he was being undermined by his cabinet due to communist influence, but his complaints fell on deaf ears. President Azaña was very much in favor of the unification of all parties, as much as it was possible in order to win the war. In fact, Azaña, Finance Minister Juan Negrín, and the followers of Indalecio Prieto on the more moderate side of the Socialist Party were frankly tired of the boomerang political ideology of Largo Caballero. They felt he was antagonizing and rehashing the instability they perceived was previously stoked by the POUM and the anarchists before and in the early months of the Civil War. If the communists were for unification, winning the war, and a republic, then it was best for everyone to line up behind them immediately. Some of these political leaders would later regret these statements supporting unification when the terrifying results of the communist lust for power became evident to all. Despite all of this political upheaval, it is fair to point out that there was progress made on the social front that did line up with the loftier ideas of many of these left-wing parties. It was reported that over 1,000 schools were opened in Republican Spain in 1937, and that over 100,000 formerly illiterate militiamen were taught to read in military schools. The number of students enrolled in school in Barcelona alone tripled. Also in Barcelona, the anarchist-led health department offered free dental and medical services, which included operations and even abortions, although they were only offered up until the third month of pregnancy. While the system of camps and prisons set up for prisoners of war were often squalid and their jailers needlessly cruel, with bourgeois and members of the clergy often shot extrajudiciously, the prison conditions on the Republican side did slowly improve over time, as opposed to on the nationalist side where they became more cruel. The sad side effect of this lessening of pointless cruelty toward nationalist prisoners, or alleged fifth columnists, was that the communists, supported by the NKVD, or the precursor to the KGB, created their own prisons independent of the central government, where they administered what they considered justice, or tried to extract information from people they determined to be spies. To bring all of these threads into a coherent historical sweater, it could be said that after the repulsion of the nationalists in winter 1937, many important actors on the Republican side appealed for unity, but there were disagreements with this at the very top of the government, with Prime Minister Caballero, and in the streets and fields of Spain with members of the anarchists, POUM, Basques, and socialists alike. In the winter of 1936-37, reports totaled the Republican forces at 350,000, but that figure was inflated and optimistic. The reality was that commanders were not excited to report deserters, or those who wandered off without leave. Many troops, as George Orwell observed, were too young to be fighting, and should have been in school instead. The regular rations provided at the front was one of the main magnets for recruits coming from cities and towns that were starving due to the interrupted supply lines and the fact that the nationalists controlled most of agrarian Spain. And those who fought in the international brigades, while extremely helpful and heroic in many cases, still had the option to abandon the battlefield and try to return to their home countries or just hide out in the respective embassies until the fighting was over. Due to the left-wing ideologies of many on the Republican side, they were loath to shoot deserters, as would have taken place without a second thought if the same situation presented itself on the nationalist side. And what attempts at military discipline were made by the government or the communists were scorned and ridiculed by the soldiers themselves and in the press. The sentiment being, what's the point of beating the fascists if we have to become them in the process? Even having to address officers in the formal usted, as opposed to the informal tú, irked some recruits to no end. Regardless, even those anarchists that were in the central government, like Frederica Monseny, had to admit that their followers' constant arguments and inability to follow orders at the front had lost them important battles, and it was necessary to consolidate leadership as much as possible. The army remained divided between the north, south, and east, but they were beginning to absorb all of the politically organized militias into brigades. But within these brigades, the political divides remained. There were really no uniforms, and the training was crude. It was said that a grenade was as liable to explode in a soldier's hands as in the presence of the enemy. Even basic skills like keeping your rifle clean was reported as unknown by George Orwell when he was fighting with the POUM in Aragon. The Air Force was highly dependent on Russia for aircraft and training, and therefore their ranks were some of the biggest converts to communism at this point in the war. Many pilots had had to spend months in Russia learning how to fly the planes, and there made friends and were influenced strongly by pro-Stalin communist ideas. They even became pretty good propagandists for the Soviet Union themselves once they were back in Spain. In the Navy, on the other hand, the officers nor their rank and file had ever shown much interest in communism. Recalling from a previous episode about the outset of the war, many naval officers were probably more on board with the nationalists than anyone else, as the Navy was one of the oldest and most conservative branches of the Spanish military, going all the way back to their colonial days. However, their sailors were of the opinion that if they didn't support the Republicans, that they should be chucked overboard or worse. Hence, their support of the Republican side was tenuous at best. The rank and file on the ships generally leaned more anarchist, but far from helping their compatriots on land, they mostly held up the Navy from taking action against the Nationalists due to their inability to agree on what actions or orders to follow, and due to the lack of discipline to carry out any mission given to them by the central government. The most important job they had, and they were mostly able to carry out, was ensuring that Russian ships were able to pass into and through the Mediterranean to Republican-controlled Spanish ports. Heading into spring 1937, the Republicans were papering over their divisions in the hope that at least the outward semblance of unity would help continue to attract international volunteers and boost their case for intervention to the British, French, and Americans. At the same time, based in the ancient university city of Salamanca, nationalists were using conscription to increase their troop numbers, and instead of providing public education to their populace on subjects like literature and political philosophy, they were training officers and infantrymen to fight on the front lines. Far from promoting literacy, many books that would have been considered mundane prior to the nationalist uprising suddenly became forbidden. Having them in your home could be used as evidence that you were a Red, which is how those on the Nationalist side referred to anyone on the other side of the conflict. The economy on the Nationalist side was good, and their peseta was stable compared to the Republican peseta, which was suffering intense inflation. They put price controls in place and forbade the exportation of goods and material that they felt was necessary for the war effort. These were pretty radical socialist ideas for people on the Nationalist side, but when a war happens, you make exceptions to your ideology. The different factions that had joined in the revolt against the Republican system, the Carlists, the Falangists, former members of the CEDA or Theta, attempted to break out from one another and press the ideas that they had been fighting for in the lead-up to the war, but Franco's concentration of power would not allow for this. What was hoped for in the Republican-held part of Spain, but wasn't really happening, that all political differences be put aside in favor of the goal of winning the war, was happening on the Nationalist side. A sign of this was in early December 1936, when the Carlist leader, Falconde, attempted to open a Royal Military Academy, with support from many in the Nationalist power structure, but not Franco himself. Once word worked its way up the chain of command, the creation of this academy was seen as a possible attempt at a coup d'etat against the Franco regime. In reaction to this, the Carlist Junta, or the organization of people that shared their ideology, agreed to cancel their plans, and their leader, Falconde, was persuaded to leave for Lisbon, which, as I mentioned in the previous episode, was a haven for nationalist leaders due to the right-wing authoritarian government Salazar had in place. Shortly after these events, Franco reorganized all of the different political militias under a rigid, orthodox military authority. This slightly alleviated Franco and his inner circle's fears that any individual right-wing political ideology would overwhelm them, and that they could take what actions they needed to take, whether they be considered conservative, or liberal, or Falangist, or belonging to the Theta, in order to win the war without having to argue about it. This didn't stop individuals in the nationalist-held areas to continue to have different political ideologies, but they knew that they should subordinate whatever goals their organization had until after the war, and they knew to keep their mouths shut if they didn't want to end up like Falconde living in Lisbon. The church was doing this especially as they were fully aware of the atrocities being committed in the prisons, camps, and on the battlefield by the nationalists. But they knew that thousands of priests, nuns, and other clergy had been shot, tortured, or imprisoned in the Republican-held territory. Their only major issue was with the parts of the Basque Country which remained extremely Catholic but unwilling to submit to the Nationalists. This caused a large rift in the church and the Vatican, as some thought that the bloodshed should be ended, or at least refrained from as much as possible by the supposed Christian side in the conflict, while others wanted every priest that supported the Republicans in the war to be excommunicated. However, whomever the Vatican ended up supporting or denouncing during the war mattered little to Franco and the Nationalists. They saw their job as clearing out territory, purging the populations as much as necessary to suppress any red political activity or hope for a Republican government in the future. They did this with executions that took place for infractions, both large and small, real and imagined. They absolutely shot any soldiers they found with guns, male or female, and put through a quick trial any officers from the Republican side before taking their lives. But they would also shoot people that were simply accused of some simple wrongdoing against a person of the right in the past, crimes that in a normal justice system wouldn't even be prosecuted for lack of evidence, and if they were, would have resulted in a fine or short jail time, were punished with summary execution. Really, any accusation that the Nationalist officer in charge of an area wanted to deal with could be lobbed at any other person, and many interpersonal conflicts were being hashed out in this way over the course of the war. And even if a person who had formerly supported left-wing parties wasn't shot or imprisoned, they would probably be pushed out of any profession they had enjoyed prior to the war, and would therefore have very little means to sustain themselves. For this reason and many others, thousands of Spanish professionals and scholars fled the country to Mexico, the US, Argentina, and many other countries to try and start a new life. Before we proceed into the spring of 1937 and the looming battles that will take place then, I'd like to discuss the international view and actions taking place in the midst of all of this in winter of 1936 and 37. Unfortunately for the Republicans, the various ambassadors, diplomatic ministries, and state departments of other democratic countries were under the impression that non-intervention could be made to work. This was even though many countries were openly flouting the agreements reached by the countries represented in the non-intervention committee. The English were especially perplexed by the clear import of war material to the Republican side in late 1936, and went in late 1936 by the Russians, and went so far as to say that the Russians were, quote, more to blame for the non-intervention than Germany and Italy. This would have been extremely frustrating and ironic for the Republicans, as they were being admonished for paying dearly for assistance when the UK wouldn't provide it, while they blithely ignored the actions of the Germans and Italians so as not to spark a Europe-wide conflict. Anthony Eden, then Foreign Secretary in the UK, went so far as to allow both sides in the conflict to board and search British ships for arms as a show of good faith to the non-interventionists. It was clear to all involved that wanted to hear it that Italy was going to back Franco and the Nationalists until the war was over. Everyone at the time would have known that Mussolini wasn't the kind of leader who was going to cash out his chips early on in a winning streak. Despite this, Yvan Delbos, the French foreign minister from 1936 to 38, put up the idea to his counterparts, Eden in the UK and Secretary of State Cordell Hull in the US, that they should convince the Germans, Italians, and Russians to enter into an agreement to stop selling arms to all sides and combine their influence to drive for a negotiated end to the war. However, this was a time of fervent anti-war sentiment in France, the UK, and the US, so any agreement that had to be backed up with possible open foreign military intervention by any of those countries was considered a dead letter. Hull directly told Delbos that no agreement entered into by any European powers should take as a given that the US would ever send large amounts of military aid in the form of material or troops ever again. Hitler sent his first chargé d'affaires to Nationalist Spain in late 1936, the fluent Spanish speaker and intensely Nazi General von Faupel. He seems to have been sent due to having spent time in Argentina and Peru helping reorganize those countries' militaries, a dark precursor of the atrocities those militaries would commit against their own people later in the 20th century, but that would be a whole other podcast, maybe even a good one. He was also not especially liked by those in the foreign ministry back in Germany due to his zealous nature. Faupel wasn't very impressed by Franco, and found his Catholic religious devotion and the high placement of the Spanish upper class and nobility in positions of power to be against his personal belief that the lower classes should be leading a fascist revolution. Nevertheless, he advised Hitler and his military leaders that they should go all out in supporting the Nationalists and that a combined 15,000-30,000 troops from Italy and Germany could win the war in no time. But Hitler showed his cynicism, saying that Spain was, quote, a convenient sideshow which occupied the great powers and left Germany free to pursue her aims in the East. In December, France and Britain presented a plan of mediation to Germany, Italy, Portugal, and Russia, wherein these six countries would support an armistice, after which representatives of each country would go to Spain to install a government composed of politicians who had managed to stay out of the war. There was one man they had in mind named Salvador de Madariaga, who was Spain's representative to the League of Nations and had resided abroad since before the Civil War broke out. However, at the same time this was taking place, two other events were happening that showed how ethereal this plan really was. While they were in theory supposed to be considering this mediation plan, the Germans and Italians met in order to lay out the next steps in their military aid to Spain. The Germans were actually looking to step down their participation in the Spanish war effort, while the Italians were looking to ramp it up for all that sweet, sweet glory that Mussolini was obsessed with. The Italians created an entire Spanish office in their foreign ministry and named a supreme commander over Italian forces in Spain, one Colonel Roata. The two countries also agreed that Italy's navy would cover French supply lines in the Mediterranean, while Germany would center its efforts on the Atlantic, such as the all-important Bay of Biscay and the waters near Gibraltar. On the other end of the fight and the political spectrum, the representative for Republican Spain in the League of Nations, without advising the Soviet Foreign Minister Litvinov or the French, brought the case of the Republicans directly to the League Council in Geneva. He called out the facts that the Italians and Germans had recognized the rebels over the elected government of Spain, that merchant ships from multiple countries in the Mediterranean were being attacked on behalf of the nationalist rebels, that it was clear that the nationalists were importing troops from Morocco to fight and kill their own countrymen, and that for all the talk of non-intervention, it was clear that aid was arriving in huge amounts for all sides, but especially from the Italians and Germans to the nationalists. All of this rhetoric only resulted in the council recommending non-intervention and mediation. So exactly the same things the non-intervention committee was supposed to achieve and was failing so hard at. A final stab to the heart of that plan was that once the mediation plan was made public, newspapers on the Republican and Nationalist side of all political leanings within Spain came out strongly against it. The idea that both sides would ever agree to stop fighting, give up on whatever hopes and dreams they and their loved ones were fighting and dying for, to let some milquetoast diplomat come in and run the place was totally ridiculous. And did anyone really think that countries with such extremely contrasting political ideologies as the US, UK, the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, and fascist Italy would really agree to stay hands off in such a mediation and not attempt to push for a leader that supported their political ends in the process? Up to modern times, at least in 2020, I struggle to think of any examples of something like this happening. When a larger country comes to mediate a war, you'd better believe they're doing it in the hopes that the result will be that the country adopts politics more similar to their own and will be an open and willing trade partner thereafter. The tensions rose higher later in December 1936 as 3,000 Italian blackshirts arrived in the nationalist-controlled coastal city Cadiz in southeastern Spain. Then the Republican Navy seized a German vessel bound for nationalist Spain, and the nationalists sank the Russian supply ship, the Komsomol. This made the democratic countries wish to seek a de-escalation, even a rhetorical one, through whatever means necessary. On Christmas Eve, without informing the official non-intervention committee, British and French ambassadors agreed that they needed to ban volunteers from joining the war as soon as possible. This was an extreme step, as the countries would be punishing their own citizens for traveling abroad of their own free will. But then the Italian minister, in the middle of these discussions, let it slip that Italo-French relations could only thaw if the French allowed the Italians to win in Spain. While the French and British were working furiously to put out the embers that could lead to a European-wide conflagration, the Italians were shipping men into Spain like it was any other colonial venture. Their numbers totaled around 17,000 troops on the ground by mid-January 1937. But Mussolini was about to learn once again that when you take really big swings, you can also embarrassingly miss and fall down in the dirt. At the same time, there were around 7,000 Germans in Spain, mostly in advisory capacities or in the Luftwaffe. It was estimated by the American ambassador in Barcelona that the Republicans had attracted at least 20,000 troops from all around the world, but the raw numbers alone were not the most important factor. Every person that arrived was undoubtedly greatly appreciated by the Republicans, but the military organization, training, and discipline that the Germans and Italians brought with them made their forces exponentially more effective in helping their side than the extremely diverse mixed brigades that were assisting the politically fractured and disorganized Republicans. It's hard to believe, but in the U.S. in early January 1937, Franklin Roosevelt actually saw to it that a resolution be passed in Congress that banned arms shipments to Spain. This didn't cover oil, so the Texas oilmen who were supplying Franco and the Nationalists were unaffected. Only one senator in the entire body opposed the resolution, stating that it would harm the Republicans more than the Nationalists, and a few members of Congress spoke against it, but it passed the Senate 81-0. I guess the one senator got over his objections as to not look like he was stoking a new European war. It passed in the House of Representatives 406-1. For all of these efforts, either purposeful or not, made by international actors in Franco's favor, he offered fervent praise. Franklin Roosevelt had acted like a true gentleman by disallowing arms shipments to Spain, while Germany, Italy, and Portugal were, quote, bulwarks of culture, civilization, and Christianity in Europe. This whole idea of preventing foreign troops from reaching Spanish ports continued to be lobbied by the French and British through January 1937, but the implications of it were vast and unworkable. I hope that having listened to now almost 11 episodes of my podcast, that you have a pretty clear picture of at least the outline of Spain in your head as I ramble on. It's like all coast, with the Spanish, French, German, Italian, and Russian navies all have ships in every port that were each allowed to search one another all the time. And leaving aside ports, what about just the open beaches that make up a great deal of the coasts and where lighter ships and boats could just land undetected at night? It was also feared by many in the British government that by pursuing this plan, they would effectively be handicapping the currently winning nationalist side. And the whole point of this diplomatic non-intervention artifice was to not be seen putting a thumb on the scale for either side in the war. This farce went on through the end of January, during which time the Germans and Italians had loaded up Spain with as many troops, officers, and material as they wanted to provide. So now it was time to throttle back. They did not, after all, want an immediate breakout of European war either. The democratic countries of Europe at this time could be said to have wanted to stem war forever, Russia included, while Germany and Italy wanted to stave it off until they were ready. In addition to this, cracks were very much beginning to show in Mussolini's personal relationship with Hitler, as can be expected when two pathological narcissistic sociopaths become friends, so they were starting to keep secrets from each other, such as the fact that they hated each other. In order to ward off war and give the Non-Intervention Committee an ersatz accomplishment, on January 28th, the Chargé d'Affaires Faupel in Spain got word from the German Foreign Ministry that Germany wanted to cut off Spain from additional supplies as effectively as possible. They were now willing to allow international observers on the non-Spanish side of the country's borders to monitor troops and supplies entering the country. Those countries in the Non-Intervention Committee would be able to patrol Spanish waters to help enforce this embargo, with each country assigned a region to cover. I can just imagine all of the members of the Non-Intervention Committee shaking hands and slapping each other on the back for having reached this agreement to stem the tide of aid arriving to both sides in Spain. Well, in reality, this had only occurred because one side had all they needed from abroad and were ready to renew the attack. But hindsight is 20/20, and even in modern times, democratic governments are happy to support a dictator, monarch, or authoritarian in the pursuit of short-term goals and long-term peace if they think that's the best way to achieve them. Next week, we'll talk about what Franco and his generals were going to do with all of this support that had been smuggled in while the Western powers bickered in smoke-filled rooms about diplomatic solutions to problems whose true natures they couldn't even speak aloud. There are three military operations that took place in spring 1937. One at Malaga in southern Andalusia, one outside the city of Guadalajara, northwest of Madrid, and another on the river Jarama, east of Madrid. In the south, we'll see the return of who I would call the Rush Limbaugh of the nationalist side, General Quiepo de Llano, who from his base in Seville would broadcast nightly screeds across the entirety of Spain, calling his enemies names and boasting that the nationalists would be dancing in the streets of Republican-held cities in no time at all. The Italians would try to flex their muscle on the peninsula with unexpected results. Many international brigades would show their courage in fighting in diverse terrains and have many civil wars in the conflict, where soldiers from the same nation would fight each other on opposing sides. By the middle of spring, any pretense of non-intervention is going to be ripped off as the Italians and Germans take actions that leave no doubt in anyone's mind who they are fighting for in the war. And above this all, Franco will float like a butterfly, only landing to take up the nectar of success and flying over his enemies and supposed allies' defeats and blunders. Because damn that guy if he wasn't lucky as a person could get. Next week, we will also talk about one of the most famous events in the Spanish Civil War, the one that was immortalized by Pablo Picasso soon after in a painting that strongly evokes the horror of what happened to that town. And that is the bombing of the ancestral home of Basque culture and heritage, Guernica.
Quieres poner bien.